For the week of May 12th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 191, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York and staying there, I'm Michael Giltz.
So what are you referring to?
I'm referring to you. Mr.
Okay.
Khan, Mr. Headed to Khan.
Okay, so yes, I am headed to Cannes, actually, and it is, I guess, the plane is waiting for me. They said, look, take your time, do the show, do the podcast, have a great show, then join us on board.
The engine is revving up, they're warming up, and they're ready to go when you step on board.
Right, and I'd like to thank Richard Branson for, you know, holding the flight for me.
That's nice. Yeah, so you're headed to Cannes. I am not. I'm staying in New York, sadly, missing Cannes yet again another year, but you'll be reporting from Cannes next week, right?
Correct, yes. Is there anything you want me to tell either Baz Luhrmann or Steven Spielberg or Nicole Kidman or Ang Lee?
Tell Baz Luhrmann I was wrong, because I thought Great Gatsby would flop when it opened, and it hasn't flopped. It certainly hasn't made its money yet, but it's had a very good opening.
Right. Not a good opening with the critics, but that's another story.
Right. So what else will we talk about on today's show?
Well, on today's show, we'll be talking to Patrick Corcoran from the National Association of Theater Owners. He's the NATO Vice President and Chief Communications Officer. Now, you might recall from our last two episodes, wherein we, and by we, I will take the blame. And I'll say that, you know, Michael requested that I make a few mistakes, and I obliged. I said, okay, fine. I know you want to look, you know, like, you know, you're as smart as I am, so I'll kind of flub it up a bit.
But I like you. You do that for me every week.
Yes, I try. But, you know, apparently we weren't exactly accurate about why NATO decided to drop Show West as the name of their annual trade show and take up CinemaCon. Nor were we correct in how the organization calculates the average ticket price for movie tickets. So Mr. Corcoran will be joining us to set us straight. And by us, I mean apparently me. And, you know, by the way, we're not all about movies. In fact, we've got a ton of television news to go over ahead of the upfronts this week. Did your favorite TV series make the cut? Well, probably not, since half of them were canceled. We also have a follow-up on our Rolling Stones ticket fiasco story from last week. Turns out the Stones concert promoter is pricing tickets exorbitantly high on purpose. We'll explain what he was thinking. During Inside Baseball, we'll tell you how one lawmaker would like for U.S. citizens to be allowed to purchase a la carte cable. Too bad it'll never happen. This bill is pretty much dead. At least, you know, not with the legislation currently being proposed. I don't think it's going to happen. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, Iron Man 3, the Robert Downey Jr. film, part of the Avengers franchise. It grossed another $161 million worldwide. It's at $950 million worldwide and counting. It's a smidgen under $1 billion after, like, what, 17 days in the theaters?
And we should point out, 17 days in theaters, not here in the U.S. I think it's around 10 days here in the U.S. But worldwide, the film made $161 million, came in first place, and is worldwide made $948 million because we focus on the worldwide box office here.
That's right. And, of course, later in television, we'll find out that ABC is going to be showing a TV show linked to the Avengers franchise called Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., starring one of the minor actors who was in the film, but a beloved supporting character who's a big part of the Avengers franchise, an agent that travels in and among all the different superheroes. He's going to have his own TV show. Will that bring down the excitement over feature films? Because they've launched one of the great franchises of all time with these multi-character, multi-film stories that they got going on. Will that help? Will that hurt? I suppose it depends how good the show is. We'll have to wait until next fall to find out. At number two around the world is The Great Gatsby, Baz Luhrmann's film, which opened in North America only. I was wrong. It opened massively. $51 million this movie made in its opening weekend at the box office. Poor reviews from the critics generally, but by far Baz Luhrmann's best opening in North America, best opening anywhere in the world. This is like triple what he's ever done before, practically. He's almost equaled his total box office for every other movie that he's released in North America. By the end of the week, it will have even topped Moulin Rouge. So within 1 week, The Great Gatsby will have made more than Strictly Ballroom or Romeo and Juliet or Moulin Rouge or Australia at the North American box office. Kind of amazing.
Well, it's weird because I don't ever recall doing box office news on a film that has yet to appear in Cannes.
Yes, that's kind of weird. It will be opening at Cannes. They took a big risk, and it sort of didn't pay off in a way because it's gotten such bad reviews. So they're going to be opening a stinker. But you know what? That happens a lot for the opening night films. What they care about are the stars, or in years past, a French connection. So in this case, they do have the stars. It's a popular success. So they'll be able to fill the Croisette with people. They'll be able to have, you know, Carey Mulligan and Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire walk the red carpet. So yeah, that's a successful opening night party. At least it's making money. And, you know, studios all over the world love that. At number three around the world is Star Trek Into Darkness, which hasn't opened in North America yet. But overseas, in just seven territories, it made $31.7 million. So a strong opening for Star Trek. At number four is The Croods, the animated film from DreamWorks Animation and Fox. That grossed another $20 million. It's at $536 million and counting. At number five, the Tom Cruise sci-fi flick Oblivion. Another $15 million. It's at $242 million and counting.
I guess you could say that's a not necessarily a hit movie, but it's not a failure.
Well, it's certainly not a failure, but what was the budget? The budget for Oblivion was $120 million. It has grossed $242 million, so it's not in the black yet. So, you know, you got to wait a little longer. Jack Reacher was in the black, but for some bizarre reason, they decided because of his deal that they needed to make four times what the movie cost in order to call it a success, or five times. I forget now. In this case, you know, what's his first dollar take on Oblivion? You know, they've just doubled their budget. So, you know, it's not in the black yet, but it's certainly not a flop commercially as far as people have paid money to see it in the theater. But it's expensive, so will they make money? Gotta wait. At number six is Pain and Gain, the Mark Wahlberg film, another $5 million. It's at $42 million and counting. At number seven is Tyler Perry Presents The Peebles. This is not a film written or directed or starring Tyler Perry, but he did produce it. It's not a success. His name didn't bring people in. They knew he wasn't in it, and there were not big stars. Though Kerry Washington does have her hit show on ABC's Scandal, which is the nuttiest show on television. That's coming back next season, obviously. It grossed $4.8 million in North America. Bit of a flop, even for a modestly budgeted film. It cost $15 million to make. It opened at $4.8 million. That ain't good. It's probably going to fall fast. Right below that is 42, the Jackie Robinson story. That's at $84 million and counting. Below that is The Big Wedding, the romantic comedy starring Topher Grace. That's at $23 million in counting. And at number 10, in slightly wider release in North America and opening overseas, is Mud, a film starring Matthew McConaughey by, what's the director? I really like him. He did Shotgun
Jeff
Stories.
Jeff Nichols.
Jeff Nichols, Shotgun Stories, and what was that crazy movie? Take Shelter.
Yes.
This made $3.8 million around the world. It's at $11 million and counting. A modestly budgeted film. We'll have to see how it's doing, but it's certainly expanding nicely.
And what's interesting about that is Mud closed last year's festival.
Closed last year's what, Sundance?
No, Cannes Film Festival.
Mud?
Yes.
What do you mean it closed the festival? It wasn't a closing night film.
I think it was.
No, it couldn't be. No way.
That's,
Mud?
I believe so. Well, I don't know if it was the closing night film, but it was definitely late in the festival.
That's a big difference. No, Claude Miller's film, Thérèse D, closed the Cannes Film Festival in 2012.
Okay, well, what do I know?
Yeah, well, that's a big difference.
All right.
I mean, I know I wasn't there, but I think I would have known if Mud had closed the festival. And number 11 around the world is Les Profs, a French comedy. It grossed $3.7 million. It's at $25 million in counting. And at number 12, a South Korean comedy, Boomerang Family. Boomerang Family, of course, is the idea that your kids come back home again. You send them out into the world, and they come back home. And that's exactly what happens when three sons return home to live with their mom, only to find out she's kind of got a life of her own. But it did very well its opening weekend, $3.6 million. And we'll have to see how it's doing.
I see this being remade in the U.S.
It sounds more like a sitcom to me. But that was South Korea. They have a strong box office. But Europe overall had a good year in 2012.
That's right. I mean, we are often faulted for, I guess, covering just the North American stories, although we do do you hear?
I hear the voodoo that you do, yes.
Yes, okay. I felt like Beavis and or Butthead there for a second. In any case, here we have a story that is all about Europe. It hit a worldwide, it hit a record in 2012 for motion picture box office.
That's right. It grossed $8.5 billion, which is a record, even though it says here, but that's not quite true. Admissions in some territories slipped, which is no surprise. They've had a terrible recession. But overall, admissions went up from 2011. Ticket sales were 313 million tickets. Ah, no, I'm sorry. There we go. That's for European movies only. What's the total amount?
I believe the amount, 27 countries of the European Union, they topped the record figure. There was a slight drop in overall attendance, and 933.3 million tickets were sold across the EU last year, which is 2.2% fewer than in 2011.
Which is pretty great given higher ticket prices and the terrible economies.
That's
right. Spain and Greece, that's actually quite good. And a third of that was for European films. So, you know, the U.S. has about 60% of the box office. No surprise, they dominate the world. But 38% were European films, so that's a good showing.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, okay, so you mentioned that there were a couple of countries that didn't do as well. So in Italy, ticket sales were down 10%, and in Greece, 6.7%, and in Portugal, 12%. And Spain actually only fell 5%, but that's because they had this huge hit, The Impossible, which, though produced in English with American, well, not American, but one Australian and one English actor, was a story that happened to a Spanish family during the 2004 tsunami in
and
Thailand.
And nothing says Spanish like Naomi Watts.
That's true. And Ewan McGregor.
And Ewan McGregor.
Yeah. Those two scream Spanish to me, but they, I guess, transplanted the story and it did gangbusters there. It was, I think, one of the top films of the year.
Right, but that's bizarre. Well, I mean, why would you say, except for a really popular film, they would have been down? Well, yes, of course. I mean, that's true. If nothing was popular, it would be worse.
Except for winning, we would have lost.
And of course, it shows yet again how North American box office does, in fact, power the world. We focus on worldwide box office because it's so important. You know, we don't know if Oblivion is a hit yet. We got to wait until the whole worldwide box office take is in. And then, of course, it'd be nice to see Tom Cruise's contract. But you can't look at North American box office to know if that movie's a success. Here, I'm talking over myself. I'm so excited. You got to look at the worldwide box office. But that is powered by North American movies and often by the success they have in North America. That, of course, is changing today. You can see Star Trek has already opened overseas. Iron Man 3 was a huge hit even before it opened in North America. So it's a changing world. But who better to talk about that than someone from NATO?
That's right. I guess actually now would be a time to get to Patrick Corcoran, the Vice President and Chief Communications Officer of the National Association of Theater Owners, or NATO. Patrick was listening to our show from, 2 weeks ago, episode 189, I suppose, and he heard us talking about both CinemaCon and its former derivation, Show West, and he also heard us talking about how the average ticket price is calculated here in North America, both of which he said we, and by we, again, I will take full credit for getting this wrong, that I got wrong. So he reached out via, I think, Facebook, and I said, you know what? Why don't you set us straight? And I invited him on the show, and he's here to join us. Patrick, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Sperling. Hello, Michael.
Hi there.
Now, I guess last week we mentioned that somebody, and I can't remember their name specifically, may have gotten wrong the fact that when Show West kind of came to an end, and I think it was in 2010 that happened, that CinemaCon took over, but that you guys didn't really want the Show West name because it was tainted.
Yeah, I mean, I tainted maybe too strong a word, but it certainly was off its peak from what it had been at its best. And it's partly just the reason that any for-profit company running a convention like that is going to be looking to take money out of the convention rather than putting money into it, which is why we wanted to take it back as NATO, so that anything that we thought was serving our members, was serving the convention, and giving a good value for the money was something that we could do and not have to worry about a third party doing it.
Well, and CinemaCon, certainly, I mean, all six studios are back. I think there's even more distributors there than ever. And we should mention that CinemaCon is a convention for theater owners and distributors and people working in the motion picture exhibition space to get together. It's the largest convention of its kind in the world each year. It did quite well this year.
It did. We had about 2,800 delegates, fully paid delegates. When you add in all the people for the trade show and all of the studio people come in there, it's over 5,000 people.
Well, and Patrick also clarified for us exactly how NATO gets their figure that they provide each year as far as the average ticket price that people pay at the box office. And the way it was described is that they ask all their members to respond with information. They make sure they get the top 10 markets, the top 10 chains, and at least 60% of all theater companies. And they take the total dollars from all the people that respond, and they divide from the total number of tickets sold to get a very simple, basic average, which is not the way we described it. But that's how they get the average ticket price for box office around the country. And in fact, people can do it at home. If you get the annual box office, which in 2012 was, I think, $10.84 billion, and you find out that at 1.365 billion tickets were sold, divided into total box office, and you get an average ticket price of $7.94, which is, I believe, exactly what you got in your more specific breakdown from reporting via company to company.
Well, it's actually a little backwards on this, because basically the admissions are arrived at using the ticket price for the larger yearly number.
And we have
a different number. We don't use Box Office Mojo. We have what we get through Red Track directly through exhibitors. And that number is $10.79 billion for the year. And then you divide that by 7.94 and you end up with a 1.36.
Ah, well, no wonder that works so perfectly. Now, that's a good basic average, obviously. Do you have the figures where you could do a weighted average, which would make it slightly more accurate as far as exactly what people are paying, where, you know, you give a weighted average as far as this number of tickets were sold at this price and this number of tickets sold at that price and so on?
No, it's a little too complex to try to do that. I mean, what we end up with is, getting from all of the major exhibitors. And I think one of the ways this skews is actually we skew a little low, or rather a little high on the average ticket price because we miss some of the smaller town exhibitors giving us their averages. It's basically taken from each exhibitor, and the weight you're going to get is from the total sold and the price they're sold at the larger exhibitors.
So not everybody responds, obviously, especially you say that's
right.
Possible that smaller markets and smaller chains, maybe mom and pop chains, are less likely to respond for various reasons. Obviously, you want to encourage everyone to respond because that would make the ticket prices average be a little bit lower, according to your beliefs, and therefore that would reflect better on the business. Are there reasons why they don't respond? Just, I guess, technical challenges, or they're so small they can't be bothered, or there's some chains that don't like to reveal that information?
Well, I think it's primarily that they're just too busy. I mean, if it's a smaller company, mom and pop are doing everything, and at the end of the day, they may be paying themselves a salary. They're not, making a huge amount of money, but they've got a good business. And the concerns of the larger industry just may not be that interesting to them. As far as the data being revealed, we never actually see what the individual companies do, how many dollars were sold, how many tickets were sold. That's given to a third party so that we have no look in on the individual company.
Right. So it's anonymous for everybody. So they have the confidence knowing that if they do respond, it will be kept anonymous and shielded from from exact facts and figures.
Well, now let me ask you something, because I think that whenever the figure, the average ticket price, is announced each year, and I guess it's announced a couple times throughout the year, and it goes up in certain parts of the year and down in other parts of the year, I think everybody, at least on the East Coast and West Coast, thinks the same thing, which is, whoa, I don't pay that. I pay much more than $7.94 or $8.04. Is there I know that it might be technologically impossible to do a weighted average, but if somebody actually came up with it and figured it out, would there be an aversion to, by NATO or anybody in the industry, to actually using that average?
Well, I think what we are looking for is just sort of an industry-wide snapshot of what people are paying to go to the movies. Not necessarily what's being charged, because that varies, and it varies by time of day. There are discounts, there are all sorts of things. So when you get into it, I mean, with the publicly traded companies, they reveal their average ticket price. So you can go and go to Regal's website and look at the documents they file with the SEC and see exactly what their average ticket price is and see exactly what their tickets sold and the box office revenue they took in. Same is true of Cinemark and Carmike, Reading. AMC files some documents because their debt was publicly traded, although I don't think it is any longer. So, I mean, that information is out there. You can sort of look and see where things are being charged by the larger companies. But, I mean, everybody does know, and this has always been sort of the case, that cities are more expensive than suburbs and small towns. and the coasts are more expensive than cities in the Midwest. And it's kind of always the way it's been. And you go back, you know, the 30-odd years of average ticket prices, and it's calculated the same way. You know, it's not any different in 1970 than it is, you know, today.
Well, here's where I get a little confused. It seems like today, with so many more chains automated and everything is already computerized, it should be a lot easier to track ticket sales and break it down by all these numbers. And I guess the chains themselves do it. But what confuses me is that every week we get a list of every movie that at the box office, right from the top blockbuster down to tiny little art house films only in one or two screens in a major city. And we know the total box office. We know the average screen, gross per screen. We see everything down to the penny, week by week by week. Then it sounds like at the end of the year, we sort of have to do a broad brushstroke grab of it. It seems like we've got all that information percolating every week down to the dollar. Why suddenly half the year point or the end of the year, we end up having to do a little more broad brushstroke analysis of all that?
Right. Well, it's actually not any more broad. The dollar figure is the dollar figure, and it comes directly out of what the sales were. In terms of, a lot of this comes out of just traditions in the theater business and the way they relate to the studios, wanting to control their information.
Yeah.
And I think there's a long thing going back, and the studios wanted to control what they knew, you know, and so it's partly out of that long tradition. We would love to have more accurate data all the time. One of the drawbacks of having as much data as we do is we have this weekend box office drama week after week after week, in a comparison to how that same weekend did the year before, which really has no bearing since it was completely different movies in the marketplace.
Exactly,
you know,
exactly.
It's like comparing, you know, how a Cadillac did to the iPhone. It's not going to really help you.
Well, that's true, though the plus side is that it makes the news every week, of course. The weekend box office is covered by virtually every media outlet you can think of in the country. So it's a curse in some ways, but it's also a blessing because it keeps movies right in front of people every week. They're discussing it. And we're seeing, I think, especially with Iron Man 3, there's a reflection. I don't know how NATO feels about this, probably a good one. The North American box office drives the worldwide box office, but we're seeing a broader recognition of how important the worldwide box office is, which, of course, you know, NATO leads the way. We saw with Iron Man 3 how widely reported it was, how well the movie was doing around the world, even before it opened up in the U.S.
Now, this is true. This is true. And I think there are a couple of lessons in that. One is that there is a world market for movies, and especially for American movies. There's some misunderstanding of how the international market works, and also its proportion. I think it has a lot of room for growth, even beyond where it is now. But if you consider that, looking at the U.S. the domestic market in a different way, which is that rather than 2/3 of the revenue comes from overseas, that 1/3 of the revenue comes from 6% of the world population.
Exactly.
Right here in the domestic market. It's a huge, huge money-making market for the studios. And additionally, they, on average, get less back from exhibitors overseas than they do here in the U.S. And when you go to China, it's even more stark, where they're limited to 25% of the box office.
Minus an 8% surtax.
Yeah.
so they're back down to 17%
right.
again.
Right. I mean, there is huge potential growth in the future. I always am skeptical when it's sort of made to seem that the domestic market is less important. I think it's incredibly important. I think what we saw in terms of growth last year was we had about 6% growth in the domestic market, and we had about 6% growth internationally. But most of the international markets did not grow that way. Europe, for the most part, was down. A lot of that growth was taken up almost entirely by China.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's actually good to know. And I guess since we're talking growth and changes here, you know, and this isn't box office related, but I'm sure NATO knows where we are with the digital cinema conversion. It's been a big topic, not only here on Showbiz Sandbox, but also in the industry at large. Where do we stand at this point with the conversion from 35 millimeter film to digital cinema, where there is no film at all?
Right. If for screens in the U.S., we're at about 87.6% of screens have converted. 34,896 out of 39,819. in terms of sites, it's slightly lower because, you know, obviously there's a multiplex converged. That's one site, but it's going to be 12 screens, you know. So, but it's in the 72% range of theaters have converted, about 4,150 out of 5,700.
And how many mom and pop chains are left? I guess we might define that you would know best, but perhaps chains with 100 or less screens on them or something like that. Are there any, are there a lot left, and how much of the market do they add up to?
It's hard to say. I think the large percentage of the remaining screens and sites are going to be the smaller companies, some just single or couple screens. We don't know for sure. I mean, some are holding out as long as possible before making the transition. Some are scrambling to get the funds together. Some are, you know, doing Kickstarter. And we're sort of, you know, day by day on when that switch gets turned off on 35 millimeter. The studios basically have, you know, given us a ballpark, but they haven't told us a particular film that it will happen on, or a particular date. But it's getting closer. I mean, it makes less and less economic sense for the studios to ship prints when there are fewer and fewer theaters that need them.
Well, not to mention the fact that there are, you know, 35 millimeter film companies that don't have the stock anymore to actually make release prints to ship out.
Right, right. And then the studios themselves have been stockpiling as much as they possibly could beforehand. Kodak says it will remain, and when it comes out of bankruptcy, that it will remain in the business of creating film stock. But that will, I think, mostly be for movie makers who still want to shoot in 35 millimeter. Complicating the issue is that there's still regions overseas where 35 millimeter is still dominant. It's shrinking, but it's still the main way for things to go. And that's Latin America is a case in point.
So that might help shore up the few places in North America left that can't afford to make the change or aren't willing to make the change to digital, where there might be prints available just because they need them for Latin America and other markets anyway?
Well, I doubtful, because they're going to be Spanish language prints.
Right. I was going to say, no.
You know, it's not going to be something that's going to be able to shift over.
Right.
And I think anyone who is telling themselves that they can really delay this in any significant way is fooling himself.
This is the last year that we're going to see a wide release film with physical prints, if any at all, right?
So we think by the end of the year. And that's as specific as we can get. We haven't had anybody commit to that kind of release yet, but it's getting closer, and the logic of it gets closer. One, because it just gets more and more expensive to strike a film print when you have a smaller and smaller run.
Right.
So you have to be looking at on a couple things. You know, you want your overall gross to be up to a certain amount. And so you're looking at what kind of a gross you can achieve from those still using film prints. And at a certain point, that number is going to get too small to make any sense at all in shipping out the film print.
Well, now, whether it's box office or digital cinema or 35 millimeter film prints, is there a trend or a story that you see the media not picking up on?
I don't know that they're not picking up on, but I think it's a little underreported, and that's the remaining diversity of the movie-going audience. It's not just the teenage boys. We don't go up or down just on the teenage boys and the fans of superhero movies. If you look at last year, we had just such a wide variety of movies out there, and it's bringing back adults over 40, adults over 50. We're getting more women coming into the movie theater, and it's because there was something there for them. I think one of our concerns on the major studio tentpole strategy, and they are responsible for, you know, 85% of our revenues, is, you know, big studio movies, is that when there are fewer and fewer of them, when one misses, we don't have something there to back it up. We don't have, you know, if you have a certain number of films that are all kind of aiming at the same demographic, maybe even the same kind of genre, when tastes change, everybody's sort of left high and dry. Well, you know, we need that diversity. We need the drama. We need comedy. We need teen films. We need everything so that there's a chance for everything to get. And there isn't an audience that's going to be left behind. You know, we don't want to send a message, which I think we did at the beginning of the first quarter, when it was R-rated action movie up against R-rated action movie, followed by an R-rated raunchy comedy, followed by an R-rated horror spoof or a horror film, you know, and we were telling a big segment of our audience, nothing to see here.
Right.
And we need a diversity of movies all year long, not just, you know, May through August, and not just at the holidays. We need it all over. And one of the really big stories of last year was the real strength of the autumn movie slate. When things started hitting with Argo and a couple other movies in that time period taken to where we're bringing adults back into the theater, and we were getting them well into, you know, the prestige season and into the holidays with big movies that were aimed at adults.
Right. Like Lincoln and Zero Dark 30 and right. A number of The Hobbit was another one that was released around that time.
Yeah, I think the one thing that was missing from that, you know, fourth quarter last year was a really big animated family film. We had Wreck-It Ralph, which did really well, you know, earlier in the late third quarter. And we had The Legend of the Guardians. But then there was a big space where there was just nothing there for that family audience.
Well, certainly I would say that I'm sorry that I made these horrific mistakes on...
you made them with gusto, so that's what counts.
Well, you know, if we're going to be wrong, as I said in last week's episode, if we're going to be wrong, we're going to be completely wrong, not just like halfway wrong.
That's right, yeah, no.
But it did give us the chance to speak with you. Patrick Corcoran is joining us from, he's the Vice President and Chief Communications Officer from the National Association of Theater Owners, or NATO. And so at the very least, I'm glad I made those mistakes for that purpose alone. And I appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate that you're more than willing to look at evidence contrary to what you've been thinking. So that's all too rare for some sections of the media.
Thanks again for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Well, that was good of him to join us. Two things I thought were interesting. One was his emphasis on a diversity of slate. That's so important to the box office. I think he's absolutely right about that. Not only because you want to reach out to a bunch of different groups, but you never know what's going to click or where the next surprise film is going to come from.
Well, you know, certainly I agree with that. I've always said, and I think NATO has always said, hey, you know what? And by the way, this is the feeling of theater owners as well. The year is 12 months long. Why not use every single month to release something? And we've seen movies like The Fast and the Furious open April and at the beginning of April to huge numbers. And I think as far as diversity goes, look at what was the name of that movie? Magnolia Heartbreak Hotel that just...
The best, you mean the... what?
Neither of us can remember it, but we remember the title, but we remember the film.
You mean the Indian film with the comedy, the gentle comedy?
Yes.
The best Marigold Hotel? Or,
yeah. Yes, thank you. Well, apparently
the best
one
exotic
of us.
Marigold Hotel.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, no, I don't know when that came out originally. Was that a spring release?
I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is the diversity there is it's not a big blow-em-up action movie.
Right, and obviously you're going to make your top 10 films are going to be dominated by tentpole movies and animated films with big budgets because you're starting off much bigger. When you can make $175 million in one weekend, that's going to hurt. But you need a healthy box office with $80 million movies and $120 million. You know, every movie can't be a home run. And you need movies that can appeal to a lot of different groups. I think he's right about that. The other thing that was interesting is that this is it. This is the last year, 2013. I mean, how many prints of Iron Man were struck, I wonder? How many physical prints of Iron Man were there? Is there going to be any movie that's going to have a wide release? And, you know, I don't know what they would constitute a lot of a big print run these days for film. I mean, how many movies will be released on, I don't know, 1,000 prints? You know, will that even be done anymore? Do they even need it?
Well, probably not, no. And that's, I mean, think about it. If you have 40,000 screens, and that's probably overestimating the number of screens in the U.S.
And almost 90% of them are already digital.
Yeah, so you don't need to do film prints. Now, as Patrick...
36,000 screens are digital, and there's only 4,000 screens left that are not digital.
Right. Hmm. And I think that, as Patrick was mentioning, sure, there are some areas of the world where film prints will still have to be struck because the conversion hasn't necessarily proliferated there. That hasn't really reached there, and it's just now happening.
They don't have the deep pockets in order to do it that quickly. Yeah, because we're such a big market, it's worth more money, and therefore it happens quicker.
Right. The problem is that kind of made film very expensive to manufacture.
And of course, you know, he's right about the emphasis on North America being important, but it's just inevitable that worldwide box office should grow dramatically, that there's no reason why the U.S. box office should be a third of the worldwide box office when we only have 6% of the population. There's no reason why Latin America and Brazil and Russia and India and China and all these countries and Africa should not be more fully exploited and become much bigger markets for movies. Hollywood may still lead the way as far as the movies that they're watching, but where tickets are sold, there's no reason why they just shouldn't become that much bigger.
Well, you know, it all goes back to certain regions of the world being what I like to call underscreened. So they don't have as many movie theaters as say we do here in the United States. And you see that happening in China, where they had been underscreened given their population. And you see 2-3 screens being built. I think it's a screen per day or more these days. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would agree with you.
Well, it's nice to know. I feel frustrated sometimes that we don't have more information about like a 3D ticket sale breakdown. You know, like what movie made what first weekend, second weekend, third weekend, how many tickets available versus how many tickets were sold. You know, you could break it down 1,000 ways to Sunday, and you know, we don't get a good handle on it because they don't release that information. It's nice to know we don't know it, but hey, guess what? NATO doesn't know either because the chains don't want to share that information.
And sometimes the chains themselves may not necessarily have that information, depending on what they're collecting.
But they'd be pretty stupid if they weren't paying close attention to premium ticket sales and how many seats are going unsold when they've overstocked their supply of 3D screens and 3D tickets.
Oh, they definitely, and, you know, yeah. good exhibitors definitely take notice of that. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. Let's move on.
Well, I suppose we should move on, Michael, but I have to admit, I am a little scared to move on, especially because, frankly, it's all because we have to talk about television.
That's right. And there's violence in television, of course. So many shows were canceled, a lot of news in television, so I think we should jump right in.
I don't even know where to begin. That's my problem.
I do. Your favorite show. Or you like Smash, right? That was the favorite show of yours that was probably canceled this year?
Yeah. I like the way you jump right into my favorite show. Well, not my favorite show, but it's a show I enjoyed watching. And we were all wondering, I was wondering whether it would get canceled. And apparently the answer is yes, it's getting canceled, despite Steven Spielberg's name being on it. And it's a big Broadway show. Well, it's canceled.
Yes. My friend's show on the CW, some shows were not canceled that I expected. I think that's more the big news. I mean, you have a thing here saying, oh, look at all these shows that are canceled. Well, that happens every year. Rarely did more than a handful of shows make it to a second season. So, you know, that's not unusual. I'm surprised that some of the borderline shows that did make it, like The Carrie Diaries on the CW, they seem to not nearly cancel as many shows as anyone expected. I mean, nothing works there, and yet they kept a lot of their shows because they just... They got nothing. All they got is The Vampire Diaries and Arrow.
I like what Entertainment Weekly did, though. They basically listed out all of the shows, right? And they said, like, The Office. Closed, so it didn't get canceled. Smash, smushed.
Those clever kids at Entertainment Weekly.
Up all night.
Are there Christine any other shows you're going to miss on this list?
No. Whitney, thankfully. 1600 Penn, impeached. Guys with Kids, you can't believe how canceled this is.
I mean, too much time on their hands.
Yeah, they really do have. Ben and Kate. And canceled.
Okay, enough.
Okay,
are there any other shows you're going to miss?
I will
None
say
of these shows.
I did put out on Twitter a comment that said, and it got a lot of responses. I said, I suppose I can delete Whitney, 1600 Penn, and Up All Night off of my TiVo.
Yes.
Since they just got canceled, so I have five episodes of each. I'm like, yeah, maybe I'll just delete them all.
Why were you saving them?
I wasn't saving them. I hadn't watched them yet.
Why would you want to watch 1600 Penn? It was terrible.
You know,
did you not watch anything of it? You just wanted to see like the pilot or something?
I saw the pilot in the first like four or five shows, and then I was like, you know, no.
It was terrible. How do you have enough room to record all these shows that you don't watch? I run out of room every week.
Oh my gosh. I don't know. That's a good question. Although I did just go through and preen all of the shows I'm never going to watch.
There's nothing on this list that I'm going to miss.
Not even Whitney?
No, there's nothing on this list. So, you know, let's move on. I think there's some highlights to be pulled out of. We've got a big new fall schedule from all the networks. They're being announced now. Still some cancellations are coming in. But rather than going through the whole schedule and shows show by show, we'll do that when we get closer to the fall season and can actually see some of the pilots. There are some highlights, I think, that we can take away from what's going on, the big trends in television. The biggest one, I think, is the return of the miniseries.
Well, I mean, I think you have shows like Downton Abbey and...
Well, that's not a miniseries.
I know it's not a miniseries. It started out as a miniseries, right? They considered it a miniseries during the...
Not really.
Right.
They always planned season two.
Right. Well, I guess...
It was only a miniseries if it flopped.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's what I tell all my friends about my own TV shows.
That's right. No, like... Shogun is being remade by Fox. That's not a potential series. That's a mini series. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
So, you know, a series where they hope to come back for season two is not a mini series.
No,
no matter how it gets classified by the Emmys.
Right, exactly. Also, reruns are spreading. They're doing year-round programming.
But the biggest mini series news, I think, like this summer we have Stephen King's Under the Dome. But the big news, I think, is the return of 24 in summer of 2014. This is a great show. I loved it. But you know what? 24 episodes was a lot of episodes. And they've turned it into a mini series. So it always sort of was a self-contained season. But next year, they're going to have a 12-hour version of 24 where each hour, they skip an hour. So they have 24 hours. It's a 24-hour time span, but we only see 12 of the hours. But that means they can actually make a better show. Because I had always thought, if, you know, if a day was like 18 hours long, that would have been the greatest show of all time. Because they always seem to have to sort of stretch out the twists to get to 24 episodes. So I think a 12-hour miniseries based on the 24 format, starring Kiefer Sutherland, coming back next year, and they plan to do it again if it's a success because they like the idea. I think that's a really fun spin on, you know, I don't know whether you call it a miniseries? They're going to bring it back a year later after that? I don't know.
Maybe you call it a postquel.
There you go, postquel. You were talking about reruns.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to move us along. I was just, I've noticed that NBC is scheduling reruns on Sunday night now.
Which is embarrassing. It's the biggest night for viewership on the week. Thursday is the most profitable because, you know, major studios like to run their ads for the trailers for their movies coming out on Friday. But Sunday night is where everybody watches TV. It's the highest viewership level of the week.
Well,
more
in
people
the fall,
watch TV on Sunday night.
In the fall, they have football. So maybe they just didn't want to have to schedule something in the second half of the season.
Well, but no, that's insane. The biggest night of the week and you're airing reruns of The Voice. That's pathetic. That's what NBC's doing. And Fox is doing it on Friday nights. They're sort of checking out. On Friday nights, they're going to rerun one of their new shows, Sleepy Hollow. They're going to air that on Monday nights after Bones, and they're going to show it again on Fridays. And that's just like throwing in the towel. And of course, Saturday night, almost none of the networks have original programming. Every once in a while, they have some sports, but basically they just show reruns of Law & Order or some CBS crime show, whatever they want. They just throw it up on the air on Saturday and throw up their hands. Now, on one hand, I think it's crazy. On the other hand, I guess it's just a reflection of year-round programming. When you have to have shows year-round and you can't show reruns, suddenly you've doubled or tripled the amount of television you're trying to program, and they just don't have the money to fill up every hour of every primetime night, 365 days a year.
I guess that's why some of these shows that have dropped 30% in ratings are being renewed. And I guess that's because networks, as you say, they just have so many holes to fill.
That's right. I mean, Glee, for example, is coming back for two seasons, which is crazy. It should not even come back for one because it's fallen so far. I guess the demos are okay still. But Glee's coming back, but it's not even going to be for a full season. It's going to air only in the fall with no reruns because they realize you can't do reruns on Glee. It's also not strong enough to go for the full season. So, hey, it's coming back. It'll air in the fall, and then something new will pop up in the spring.
Well, and you also mentioned here in our show notes that sitcoms, there's just no good sitcoms anymore, and nobody has created a good one since Modern Family.
Well, at least a hit. I mean, we've had, you know, Girls, of course, on HBO. That's a hit on pay cable, but we're talking about the networks here, and everybody wants a hit sitcom. Everybody knows they need one. We have The Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men in the top 10, but they're getting quite old, quite long in the tooth. How I Met Your Mother is shutting down. That's never been a huge hit. The Office was barely in the top 80. And that's closing shop. Everybody wants a hit sitcom. They didn't find it last year, and they're all looking again. You got Michael J. Fox in a new sitcom, Sean Hayes, a lot of familiar faces trying to find a hit sitcom.
Based on what I've seen, 5 minutes clips of each, the Michael J. Fox, I don't even know what that's called.
The Michael J. Fox Show.
Oh, okay. And the Sean Hayes Show. I don't think the Michael J. Fox Show will last, although, again, it was only 5 minutes. And the Sean Hayes Show was hilarious.
I predict you will be wrong right there.
Really? Okay.
Even having seen neither, Michael J. Fox has so much goodwill. I mean, why would you judge it based on 5 minutes?
Hey, last week I picked the Tony Award winners.
That's true.
I hadn't seen a single show. So I don't know.
A lot can happen between now and the show launch. I think I would take more positive from stuff rather than negative, because things can change. They can rework it. They can do this. They can do that. They can recast. Whereas if you think it's good now, it'll probably only get better.
Hey, let me ask you this. Speaking of sitcoms, have you seen any of the shows on the Amazon Prime?
No, I haven't.
Some of them are really good. I saw this show.
Meanwhile, you've got Whitney and 1600 Pen piled up and you're watching Amazon Prime television.
Well, right.
Are these the pilots that people say, they say, which one do you want us to make?
Right. And Betas, the kind of Silicon Valley sitcom, really good.
Really good. Define really good. Really good, like it should be on a network television show right now, would be a hit.
I think if it was on a network television show, there'd be certain things you couldn't do, like profane language, for one.
What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
Sorry, kids. Don't curse.
If anything, just say HE double hockey sticks. Everybody knows that.
Oh, my God.
Who has kids?
Ozzie and Harriet now.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that was good. And Alpha House was hilarious with John Goodman and a whole bunch of senators living in the same house in Washington.
Oh, it's based on the real house in D.C. where some senators room together, because they all have homes back in their state. And so a number of them room together every once in a while in some big homes or some places that they rent out. Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's very.
Are they all Republican or liberal? Or is it a mix of everything?
They're Republican.
Okay.
They're all Republican. It's actually very funny. And those two shows were very good.
Huh, well, that's interesting. So the networks, are feeling the heat. They've got, even Amazon Prime is making pilots for original programming, and they're sort of they're feeling it. A&E was sort of making fun of them. They had an upfront. A lot of cable channels did displays of all their new shows and stuff. A&E, of course, is red hot on their trio of channels. You know, A&E and History, etc. They had the Bible miniseries. They had the Vikings TV show. They got reality hits like Duck Dynasty and Pawn Stars. And their ad sales exec was mocking the networks. He said, next week, you'll hear our broadcast ancestors make the argument for why less costs more. And he's mocking the idea there that major networks get to raise the cost of their ads even as their audiences continue to shrink. And he goes on to say, if you're tired of paying a failure tax, we have lots of successful programs for you to invest in.
That's what he said.
That's pretty nasty. But of course, cable is outpacing network. I mean, there's hundreds of channels, so it's only natural that they would book more ad dollars because they got so many more hours of programming to sell ads for. But last year, cable booked $9.8 billion, and the networks took in $9.2 billion. Some people think, well, obviously, cable will continue to book more. Will the networks even drop? Is there just a maximum amount of ad dollars to be spent, $18 billion, $19 billion? Or will the big pie keep growing as more and more channels are available?
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, that must be just for upfronts.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense, actually. Because I was going to say the television advertising pie is a lot bigger than just, $20 billion.
Well, but that's a lot.
Yes.
It's a big chunk. That's a big chunk of the deal, and it sets the tone for the season.
That's two North American movie industries.
That's right. And setting the tone for Warner Brothers TV is a little Schadenfreude, or what is it here? What do we call this?
I don't know. I guess we all saw it coming, Freud. I don't know. Okay.
There you go. What happened?
Well, we talked many episodes ago, and I can't even remember when, but it was earlier this year, about how Warner Brothers...
I think it was episode XXL.
Right.
That's how long ago it was.
Well, it turns out that Warner Brothers, they picked their CEO. There was this kind of runoff between, Kevin Sugihara and Bruce Rosenbloom and the head of the motion picture department, whose name is now completely escaping me.
How embarrassing.
Jeff Robinoff. Sorry.
There you go.
Wow, that was weird. And Kevin Sugihara was chosen as the next CEO of Warner Brothers, and leaving the other two to, I guess, continue in their current positions. Well, Jeff Robinoff said, hey, great. Let's keep going. Let's, I plan on supporting Kevin. Let's keep making money. Whereas Bruce Rosenbloom said, well, I'm kind of, that's great. It's wonderful. Well, Kevin Sugihara, the new CEO, said, look, let's not make this any more awkward than it has to be. You're fired.
Did he fire him?
I don't know. I mean, Bruce Rosenbloom is exiting, so maybe it was his own decision to say, look, I'm going to be leaving. But certainly Sugihara didn't prolong the stay. Let's put it that way.
And what about the other guy?
The other guy is still there, and he's doing a good job. And by the way, Warner Brothers' television, they're doing a good job, too. So you know, I don't know necessarily why you'd want to get rid of somebody like Bruce Rosenbloom, but we'll see.
Well, a little awkward.
Speaking of people who are doing well, but you're getting rid of them anyway, is Jay Leno. You know, here in the United States, there are these sweep months, and February's one, May is another, and it's kind of going away, but it used to...
I should hope so. It's where they stockpile all their big specials to try to get big ratings so they can charge you more money for their ads for the rest of the year. So they want to charge you more in June, July, and August because of how they did in May.
Right.
Makes no sense, but that's what they do.
Well, it was at a time where it was harder to collect the ratings and how many viewers watched a particular show. It wasn't available overnight via the internet.
No, but that's all the more reason why you should just
get rid of it.
Yeah. Constantly have you know, information pulled and constantly update your ratings, you know, the ad sales based on your actual ratings rather than what happened 4 months ago.
Right. Well, you know, the reason I bring all of this up is because we're in the middle of May sweeps right now. And for the first week of May sweeps, and that's April 29th to May 3rd, guess who the number one late night talk show host was?
Mr. Chin himself, Jay Leno.
That's right. Unbelievable. So he actually won handily with 3.4 million viewers on average during that particular week, which was better than CBS's The Late Show with David Letterman, which had 2.8 million viewers, and of course better than ABC's Jimmy Kimmel, which had 2.5 million viewers. And
nobody likes old people, so the only thing that really matters is how did he do in the important demo, adults 18 to 49.
He won there as well.
Handily?
Well, I don't necessarily know. His ratings in that demo...
He got a million. He got a million viewers.
Yeah.
Compared to Kimmel's 820,000 and Letterman's 766,000.
Right.
But Letterman was third in the key demo, and second in overall viewers. I have to say, watching Night to Night, however, Kimmel has been second, first, third, second, second. I mean, he's been up in there. It's, you know, some nights Letterman wins because he's got such a huge lead in. He's got those big powerhouse CBS shows, which are by far the top ranked shows. NBC has nothing on at 10 o'clock. So, you know, it goes into local news, but you ultimately have an effect based on your prime time. So Letterman has a big lead in, and some nights he wins, and it's a lot more fluid than I thought. And I have to say, Kimmel is in the mix a lot more. He's not third regularly. He is second sometimes in overall viewers. He's first sometimes. So, you know, they're probably frightened out of their minds because they see him already in there establishing himself, and that's why they want to bring in Jimmy Fallon.
Right, and so they are bringing
in... I don't agree with it, but that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, hey, thanks for coming in first. We're going to replace you. You know, it's like, I'm
right,
sorry, Mr. Phelps, that was a great swim. Listen, you're not swimming in the next heat.
Yeah, like, so, what? I mean, he's got almost a million more viewers than Jimmy Kimmel, and yet he's fired.
Right, and they're bringing in Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Fallon is presently hosting the late night show over on NBC.
And who's going to take that over? Big shocker.
Seth Meyers, who is on Saturday Night Live as the Weekend Update host. He's also the head writer over at Saturday Night Live, produced by Lorne Michaels. And guess who produces Late Night?
Lorne Michaels.
Right. So he's basically being repositioned, I think, in a better job, frankly. I mean, they're both great jobs, but you're on TV every single night now.
But oh, my God. I mean, late night television. Please give us a woman. Give us a person of color. Give us something.
Well,
you know,
thought
we had
Arsenio
George
Hall's
Lopez, he got dumped. We got Arsenio coming back in syndication. But my God, you know, I mean, to have the Weekend Update guy in two shows on Prime, it's exhausting. How will you even tell the difference between Fallon and Myers?
Well, probably through Nielsen ratings, which, by the way, are changing a bit. In fact, Nielsen, the company, they are going to be expanding their definition of what they constitute as a television home, and they're going to be including hundreds of thousands of houses or dwellings or apartments, I don't know what you want to call it now, that have a broad...
Domiciles.
Thank you. Ooh. Where's your dictionary? They're going to basically look at those domiciles that have broadband internet connections and people who may not have cable, but they're watching television on, through Amazon or through Netflix or some other form. They're counting them as television households now.
So the Nielsen family will now include people who have a television set.
Right.
Even with rabbit ears, people with cable, people with satellite, and now people who just have broadband. If you've got broadband, you are potential Nielsen family.
Correct.
Okay. That makes sense.
But they're saying, hey, look, you know, in the United States, this will increase the number of households with televisions by 1.2%. And so I guess there will be an estimated 115.6 million homes with televisions, according to Nielsen, starting in September. None of them, by the way, will be watching Smash.
And no one can explain to me why they can't just get real-time data from all those cable companies that are plugged in and know every change of the dial I make. Well, why they can't get 80 million homes telling us what people are watching rather than this bizarre sampling system is beyond me.
Well, you know, part of it is privacy issues, and that was...
It's not privacy issues, but they track what you do now, and no one's saying I want them to say what Michael Giltz is doing. You just track generic.
Right. I mean, there was a large... I read this...
I mean, I know you wouldn't know who's sitting there watching the show, but at least you could say, all right, 80 million homes were tuned in to this. It seems a lot more interesting than what they do now.
Which is basically a survey.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And a survey overseas talked about what the best shows of the year were in Europe. So another European story, the BAFTA Awards, they're basically the British Emmys. They were announced, and it's good to see some American shows triumphed in the international category. HBO's Girls beat out Game of Thrones, and Homeland to win the Best International Show. Why doesn't the Emmys have an award for Best International Show as well? I wonder.
Yeah, because the show's not long enough. They need some filler. Maybe they could do international.
Nothing wrong with a good award. You know, the problem with the Emmys is not, you know, too many awards. The problem is how the show is done.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, the Grammys have tons of awards. They don't show them all on air. You know, just because you add an award doesn't mean you have to show it on prime time. But, you know, why not, you know, herald the best international show in North America? It might have been Borgen last year, which was Stephen King's favorite show, a very solid Danish drama. I think it's Danish. I always get confused whether it's Danish or Dutch. I believe it's Danish. Very good political drama.
Does it come
drama.
From Denmark or Holland?
It's a Danish show.
Right.
It's about the first female prime minister of Denmark.
Right. Okay. So, yeah.
So that might have been the best international show. It's an interesting thing they should highlight. I like the fact that the UK does it. But more important to us, I like to see what win the big UK awards so we know what shows to keep an eye on. The best comedy was 2012, a spoof of the Olympics. And the best drama sounds interesting. It's called Last Tango in Halifax. It's a romantic drama about new love among elderly people starring Derek Jacobi. So that sounds charming, and that won the best drama. So I'm sure those will come to American television on some cable channel, and I look forward to seeing them.
Well, Steve Coogan won another award for playing his, I guess at this point, kind of famous or infamous character, Alan Partridge. I think that is kind of funny. He's a late-night talk show host, or a chat show host, as they say in the UK, but he does it in character.
Right, long before Larry Sanders, he had this show. It started as a radio DJ, Alan Partridge, and then he moved into television chat show. And he's been doing this for decades. And he's tried to get a feature film off the boards, but it's never happened. But he's been doing, you know, he does 6 episodes and 12 episodes and different variations of this guy, different periods of his life, keeps following him. And his latest one about Alan Partridge won another award at the BAFTAs, so that was nice. And Graham Norton, who I've interviewed, was the host of the BAFTAs. He does what they've never really had before, which is a nightly talk show. Speaking of talk show hosts, he does what Johnny Carson did in North America. They didn't have that in the UK. People would do like once a week or once for 12 weeks and then stop and rest for a year. You know how the Brits are. I'm British, by the way. But Graham Norton was doing it 4 nights, 5 nights a week. It was brand new for them. They never saw anything like it. And he's been doing it. He won basically Best Entertainment Program. He didn't win Best Host. Somebody else won that, but his show did win Best Entertainment Program, which is the category for chat shows like the Graham Norton show. So congrats to him.
You know, I always wondered where your accent was from.
Crikey. Oh, no, wait, that's Australia.
Yeah, wow. Okay, well then, I think before we try any other jokes out, we should probably move on to music. And a lot of our listeners...
It's another follow-up.
Yeah, it's another follow-up, because last week we talked about the Rolling Stone ticket sales for their current North American tour, or I guess lack thereof.
Which one commentator blasted as having horrible ticket sales. They were not selling out. They're going to have half empty houses. They were having to slash prices.
Right. And then every other media outlet jumped on the bandwagon there. And, you know, hey, thank you all who wrote in and talked about this and gave us some feedback about this. And many of you sent in links to stories about the subject, and specifically one from Rolling Stone in which John Meglin, the co-president of...
That's Billboard, I think, actually.
No, it was... So, you're right. It was... You're absolutely right. It was Billboard. My mistake. But they interviewed John Meglin, who is the head of Concerts West, which is an AEG Live subsidiary, and he is the concert promoter for this tour that the Rolling Stones is on right now.
And he said, no, we're not having bad ticket sales. We're just trying to screw over the brokers.
Yeah, he's saying, look, no. Here's the deal. we are doing something that's called flex pricing. We are, all these tickets are flex priced, which means they start out at $600 at the on sale, and then they move to $450 when sales finally stall. And
it's like what the airlines do sometimes.
Right. And they say, this is a strategy that has been tried in the past, and it's working here too. It's a strategy that usually we do for what they call the lower bowl, so the seats closest to the stage along the sides.
The expensive seats.
The expensive seats. But now they're doing it all the way around the arena. So, and I mean, I found this interview fascinating, if only because he was at an airport when giving this interview, and you almost want to say, you know that you're talking to a reporter, right?
What do you mean?
Well,
it wasn't a trick.
No.
He was talking to Billboard.
No, I understand that, but he starts talking about things that were kind of always known in the industry, but never discussed openly. They never really say, oh yeah, no. We have 15,000 tickets. We'll give 6,000 to the secondary market. So we'll give.
Well, let's explain what's going on here. So he said he's trying to downplay this story, saying that the Stones concert was selling poorly. He says, no. We have really high priced tickets, but that's just because we're sick of seeing the brokers get all that money. We want to get the money for ourselves so we can sell tickets at $600. We'd rather do it ourselves and let the brokers do it. But in doing that, what did he admit to?
Well, he admitted to selling tickets to the secondary market or through the secondary market.
Right. So big acts like Bruce Springsteen and Billy Joel, I don't mean to single them out, but a lot of big acts, perhaps all of them, would hold back tickets. And they'd say, all right, we're going to charge 150 face value, but then they would sell them to brokers for like 300 or 400 because the brokers would know they could get even more on the market. So they were too embarrassed to charge $300 or $400 a ticket, but they wanted to make more money. So they'd hold back a pile of tickets, sell them to the brokers at a higher price, or take a cut from the broker sale, or however it worked, I don't know. But they were too embarrassed to charge a face value of, say, $300 or $400 for a ticket, but they'd let the brokers do it and profit from that. So the artists themselves would profit from that along with the brokers, but they would have the protection of not actually having to charge $400. So when you were angry that those $150 tickets were snapped up and gone, and then you went to a broker and suddenly you had to pay $400, you were angry at the broker, not at Madonna. But in fact, Madonna was handing tickets to the broker. And I'm naming names, but I can't do that because I'm making it up. I'm just using generic big name acts to say that. But that's what was going on. They didn't want the shame of charging massively high prices, but they did want the money. So they handed them over to the brokers and either got a cut of the sale or just charged them a lot more than they did, knowing the broker could mark it up even further. Right.
And really, it's the concert promoters that do this because...
No. It's the acts. They don't do it without the acts' permission. They're not doing anything behind Bruce Springsteen's back or Madonna's back or Prince's back. If it happens, it's because the artist agrees to it.
Well, I'll tell you that, you know, Springsteen, you keep mentioning Springsteen. He actually does general admission on the floor specifically to avoid this issue. So he's saying, you know, yeah, you got a great seat. You have a general admission ticket and you paid $700 for it. You could be standing in the back of the auditorium because it's general admission. If you don't get there early, you may not be up front. So
that's nice. But all these acts, if they say we just want to keep them out of the brokers, we wish we didn't have to charge this much money, but we're forced to because they make so much more money on the aftermarket. They all know what they could do. Say, bring an ID to the concert and get your ticket there. And, you know, then you get in with the credit card and or ID that you used to buy it. And then you wouldn't have resales. And so they can control who gets the ticket. They don't have to charge $400. They can just set up a system so if you buy the ticket, you got to show up and walk in. And that means, guess what? The people who paid $150 for that ticket get to show up and sit wherever they're supposed to sit. So they can't moan about, you know, the brokers and all this stuff. But that's one thing he admitted. What else is going on? Are ticket sales actually good or are they bad for the North American leg?
Well, he's saying, now this is the promoter of the concert tour, so... You know, take it for what it's worth. He's saying that no, they're selling out. They're selling about 15,000 tickets per show at 240 to 260 degrees. So they're not selling behind the stage. That's what he's saying there.
I see. I would be shocked if the Stones couldn't sell out like a 15,000 seat arena after playing football stadiums for all those years. And it's towards the end of their career, so it's a kind of a last chance. But they got a new show at the Honda Center in Anaheim on May 15th. 36 hours away from when we're recording the show. And right before the show, I went online to Ticketmaster. Guess what? I can buy 8 tickets on the floor for $630 a ticket. No problem. I can get great seats right now on the floor. There's 4 levels of tickets. The $175 tickets, sold out. The $280 tickets, you can only get a single seat here and there. the $450, whatever that level is, you got a lot of tickets there. And the $630 level, tons of tickets there. So basically, what I see is 36 hours before the show, the cheap seats are sold out, but nobody wants to pay for the really expensive seats. Now, we'll have to see what happens about what the actual, you know,
the take is,
the capacity is, how many people are there. Will they have to, you know, paper the house and just give away tickets, and therefore the gross will be down, but the audience will be full? I don't know. But 36 hours before a show, you shouldn't have seats available on the floor at eight seats together in a row. That's not good.
You know, he says here, this is John Meglin, the head of Concerts West, talking. He says, did we hit a point where we ran out of people that would pay or buy at $600? Yeah, but why can't we do the market value thing? Why do we have to let the market value proposition live with the scalpers? Why should, in my estimation, $3 million go to the brokers instead of the artists in every one of these markets?
I agree with him on that. I mean, if they want to charge $600 for a ticket to see the Stones, they should be able to, of course. And why let the broker snap away all the tickets? But if they wanted to stop the brokers, they don't have to do it by raising the ticket price. They can charge whatever they want, but there are other ways to stymie the brokers without doing that. Plus, of course, as he admits, they used to hand them the tickets all the time.
Yeah, he says here, the bottom line is we wanted to take brokers out and get to what the real gross in a venue was. If you go online and see what the brokers are selling tickets for, we took the lion's share of the money from them and we're giving it to the artists. Personally, I want the brokers pissed off. I want that money going to the artists. And by the way, we have not put a single ticket on the secondary market on this tour, and we don't need to, because we went and took the broker's margin out, and that's why they're all screaming and making noise. And and that's what I meant by you almost want to remind him he's talking to a reporter, because very rarely, if ever, do you hear a concert promoter talk about dealing directly with the secondary market.
Right. It's been an open secret for so long. I guess he figures, what's the big deal? And the Stones have always pushed the envelope on ticket prices. So again, there's no shame for them in charging a high ticket price. They don't need to build an audience for the future like some young act. But, you know, hey, we'll have to check out the venues and see what actual ticket sales are like and what the grosses are once we get some figures from the North American tour. Certainly, as we said last week, overseas, they did really well for the shows in Hyde Park and some other European venues. So we have no evidence yet that they're not selling well, other than the report that we gave last week and the fact that 36 hours before showtime in Anaheim, you can get tons of tickets on the floor at $630 a ticket.
But, you know, that price is kind of hefty.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's a big deal.
Oh, really? It's a big deal? Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story to me makes no sense at all. It's from Upside Down Land, or, you know, it's like
Bizarro World.
Yeah, it's weird. Barnes & Noble is struggling, but that hasn't stopped potential buyers from circling the various divisions of the company. Barnes & Noble's own chairman, Leonard Riggio, wants to buy the 689 physical bookstores from the chain. It's not clear if he would close down 200 of them the way the company currently plans. Now Microsoft wants to buy their digital reader, the Nook. The device has received good reviews, but it simply isn't competing against the Kindle and iPad and Kobo, and it's hemorrhaging money. That whole digital division is hemorrhaging money. Microsoft already invested $605 million into the division and now reportedly will spend $1 billion to get the rest. And what will they do with the Nook once they own it? What do you think? They'll get rid of the hardware and just concentrate on selling books via third-party apps on tablets and other devices. Barnes & Noble stock jumped 25% on the day of this potential sale, or this potential deal was announced. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big confusion. If Barnes & Noble sells the stores and they sell the Nook, what the hell is left?
Well, I think what he's trying to say is, hey, I don't want all of this digital. And this is Leonard Riggio speaking, the chairman.
Yeah.
He's saying, I just want to go back to being a bookstore. I don't want this digital division. I don't want any of this digital
stuff.
But
I mean, I'm saying if Barnes & Noble sells the stores, is he just taking the company private, or is there supposed to be some other company left over after he's bought the stores and Microsoft bought the Nook? Is there some third party still existing, or is it just the stores owned by Leonard Riggio?
Correct. The latter.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, what's left? But I mean, that just seems insane. Like, why do they want to spend $1 billion for something that they want to shut down?
Well, basically what he wants to do is...
No, them, Microsoft. Oh. Why do they want to spend $1.6 billion on a product that they want to close down? Just develop your own app. Surely that's cheaper.
Well, I don't think they would shut it down. I think they would keep it going. I think they would keep the Nook around.
Well, that's what they say. They're saying that they'd shut it down.
Well, there's been conflicting reports on that.
All right. So you think that's crazy? Because it is.
Yeah, it's pretty silly. And what Leonard Riggio is saying is, look, you guys take the Nook, Microsoft. We'll sell it. In fact, we'll sell the Kindle. We'll sell the Kobo. We'll sell all the readers. In fact, on our website, we'll sell books in Kindle format and Nook format. And, you know, so that way...
He said he wants to sell the physical Kindle in his store?
Well...
No.
That's a prognostication. That's that's my punditry at work.
Why would he do that? That's pure sales for a competitor.
Yeah, well, if he doesn't have
They don't make it easy for you to put your Barnes & Noble books on a Kindle.
No,
you can do it. If you're a tech guy, you can strip out the digital rights management, but it's not a one button thing. Like you can read Kindle books on an iPad or your tablet, or probably I imagine your Nook. I don't know, but it don't work the other way around.
Yeah. I have no idea what Leonard Riggio is thinking at all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What's Gerald Molin thinking?
You know, I've wondered that for some time. I wonder really why we keep hearing about him. He is the Oscar winning producer. And this is Gerald Molin we're speaking about. He worked on Schindler's List. He sent a letter to the Academy complaining that director Michael Moore, the documentarian, is a biased liberal who shouldn't be a gatekeeper for the documentary films category.
Molin, he sits on the board, I guess, of the Academy and is involved in documentary films.
Right, okay. As do many others, by the way. But Molin's film, 2016 Obama's America, we talked about that last year, that's for sure. It was passed over this year, despite being the top grossing documentary of the year and one of the most successful of all time. Molin blames Moore, along with the director Michael Apted and Rob Epstein, and frankly, probably every single person on the board, but also members of the Board of Governors, he's blaming, and to his mind, all of them are raging liberals. Molin goes on to compare it to The Blacklist, and this is a quote, "We've already experienced a time in Hollywood where an atmosphere of oppression and fear were prevalent and people were punished for their political views. Let us make sure that never happens again." And that was said in his letter, and it was quoted by The Hollywood Reporter. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
So he's comparing not winning an award
to The Blacklist,
to being drummed out of Hollywood and having your life and career destroyed.
Yeah.
Releasing a massively successful documentary film in America is equal to The Blacklist. Fascinating. Well, first of all, and I like his little preemptive strike. He says, I bet the sequel to 2016 that they're making right now, I bet that will be ignored next year as well.
Probably.
The fact is, look at Rotten Tomatoes. The movie has a horrible rating. It's terrible. 26% positive reviews, only 15% from top critics, though, of course, he would say they're all liberals. But
yes.
It was a horribly reviewed film. A terrible documentary film, according to most critics, some of whom I assume are not liberal. And the fact is, grossing a lot of money does not mean you're going to get an award nomination. If you look at the top 10 films of 2012, like The Avengers and Dark Knight and Skyfall, none of them got nominated for Best Picture either. And some people thought they should. Ted wasn't nominated for Best Picture. I mean, on and on. So being the top grossing film doesn't mean you get a nomination for Best Picture or Best Documentary. So, you know, he's just silly on about 8 different levels.
I think the Academy is a bunch of foul-mouthed teddy bear haters.
Exactly.
YouTube, once the home of cat videos and now the home of just about every stray video you can name, is tentatively adding in pay channels to its free universe of videos. Formerly, YouTube, of course, was all free. Then they started adding in commercials for those who wanted to monetize all those people watching their videos. If you had a hit video and could get people to watch, you know, a 15-second ad beforehand, the video began, you know, you'd make a lot of money. Then they added links to buy the music contained on a video or buy the artist you were watching. Now they've taken it one step further. There are, you know, around 30 channels right now, I think, they launched that will charge anywhere from $1 to $3 a month to access their content. Among the first to try it out, Sesame Street, National Geographic, and the UFC, the Ultimate Fight Club, or what does UFC stand for exactly?
It's mixed martial arts.
Okay. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop because it's just a modest step forward. We'll have to see how it works. We'll have to see if it's the way of the future, whether people accept it, you know, from these name brand places like Sesame Street, or whether they feel like they got enough access to content lots of other ways and it doesn't pan out. It's a reasonable thing to experiment with.
Well, then what do you think about this announcement that Condé Nast made? They're going to be launching a Vogue digital channel, and I guess it's going to be joining channels that they've already created.
Where will they be?
Everywhere. They're going to be on YouTube. They're going to be on Vevo. They're going to be on Daily Motion. They're basically becoming a content producer, and they'll distribute on tons of different platforms.
Like what content? What do you mean?
So they'll have a whole, you know, like six original programs, six original series, much the way Amazon is and Netflix are creating original content that they then distribute rather than on television. They're going to distribute them through the internet.
Well, you know, I mean, everybody wants original programming, and you can see Amazon and Netflix imitating cable and networks by saying, hey, we need our own signature series. But when you get to like newspapers and magazines and digital websites that don't have any history of creating programming, I mean, I guess there's no reason why they should be any more or less successful than Netflix. Netflix never created programming, but they were sort of in the programming business, whereas Vogue is in the magazine business. So what do they know about creating good shows? I mean, I guess they could, but I look at the New York Times and they do a terrible job with their little videos. I think they're just boring. So, you should be good at what you do first. I guess they figure they're successful enough now they want to branch out into video, but it's a whole different ballgame. So one does not translate to the other. It seems like a lot of money and a lot of expense to try and do something that's really not in your wheelhouse.
Well, then let's move on to our next story with rumors swirling that Fox was planning to dump the entire judging panel from American Idol. Mainstay Randy Jackson perhaps beat them to the punch and announced that the 12th season on Idol would be his last. It was a given that superstar Mariah Carey would be gone, so perhaps Jackson also felt since he brought her on the show, he should leave with her. With ratings in a free fall, change was definitely needed. But why exactly they're dumping Keith Urban and Nicki Minaj is really less clear. Minaj apparently is a divisive figure. Some people love her, some people hate her, and she's always good for a quote. Divisive? What about Simon Cowell? He was divisive. Apparently the only face we're guaranteed to see in season 13 is host Ryan Seacrest. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, I guess, that Randy Jackson is leaving. It's been 12 seasons. The show's in free fall. It's barely in the top 10 some weeks. It's like ranked 9th and 10th, tied for 10th. It's really falling hard and fast. And, you know, well, I don't know what they're going to have to do to save it. It's still the number one show on Fox, but boy, the times are hard. But seeing Randy Jackson go seems the least of it. But Nicki Minaj, to me, seemed to do really well. I don't know why they dump her.
Speaking of people that are leaving, about a month ago, news leaked that Barbara Walters was going to retire. She testily announced on The View that she had no such plans, by which Walters apparently meant she hadn't been ready to announce her retirement or was annoyed that it leaked. Anyway, now she's announced on The View that she is retiring in the summer of 2014, but will continue to oversee The View and replacing Joy Behar, if not Elizabeth Hasselbeck, as hinted before. ABC will squeeze all the ratings mileage it can out of this event with numerous primetime specials. You know that's coming down the pike. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, not in the sense of how it affects The View or the fact that she was clearly towards the end of her major career, but she's a big figure in television. And I think the best example of that is the fact that NBC is about to announce, perhaps, it looks like, that the new head of their news division will be a woman, which is the first time that's happened. They never even had a woman in charge of the morning news programs, which is bizarre since Today, Good Morning America, and the CBS show are all geared towards women. Never been in charge of that. Now, finally, a woman is going to be in charge of NBC News. Barbara Walters was there first. She blazed the trail that all these women are following in her path. So it'll be a fun year. You can have some good specials out of it. I hope they do it right because she is a substantial figure in television.
She's also 84 years old. So the fact that she's retiring, not a huge shock.
Exactly.
Right. Well, that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. And Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week's story really could affect you, although I think, and I think, Michael, you'd agree with me, it never will. And that's because Senator John McCain he's going to try and introduce a bill on cable TV that has something to infuriate. I think if you were really to look at it and read it carefully, there'd be something in there to piss off just about everyone. Every element of the cable TV industry, sports. He's been down this road before, of course, in 2006. But the congressional paper, The Hill, that's the media outlet up there, says he's ready to tackle it again. What's in the bill? and what isn't. So let's talk about that. It would force cable companies to offer channels a la carte. So there's your a la carte programming that everybody wants. It would force cable channels to stop bundling so that you wouldn't be forced to get ESPN3 if you just wanted ESPN.
Yay, say the cable companies.
Yes, because right now I pay for ESPN Español. It would buttress Aereo by taking away the broadcast license of anyone who dumped their over-the-air programming for cable only. So if they went cable only, they would have to sell their spectrum. And as a capper, it would end the sports blackout rule, which says cable channels can't show, for example, a football game, you know, on air if the stadium locally isn't sold out. In other words, he's toying with cable companies, major networks, massive media conglomerates, and, of course, major sports franchises. May the force be with you.
Yeah, now, to explain again, there's a blackout rule that if, like, the football game is not sold out, it can't be shown on local TV. And cable has been forced to, you know, to stick to that rule in that market so that they would not show it in that market because they want people to buy tickets to the games. And that's a big, important thing for franchises in football and baseball and elsewhere. And, you know, they would love to end that. The cable people would, but the franchises, the football people would hate it. But what would they hate even more? Would they hate the fact that ESPN would be sold a la carte? Why would they care about that? Because they don't own ESPN. So why would it matter to them?
Well, because their fear right now is that, gee, we have to charge $150 to just for basic cable. We're having to charge like $125 to all of our customers.
No, the sports franchises, why would they care if ESPN got less money for its channel?
Oh, well, that's another story entirely, whether it's ESPN or, say, the Dodgers Network or, yes, the Yankees Network. Because right now, the Dodgers Network, yes, MLB, ESPN, we are all forced to pay for that. And we pay at a very high rate. So if I'm paying my cable bill and I never watch sports, I pay $3 a month for ESPN. I pay $2 a month for MLB. I pay $1 a month for the NBA Network, even though I never watch them. And what that does is subsidize
all the massive franchises and right. Their big payrolls and all that.
Right.
Because that's where they make all their money, even more than the stadium seats now.
That's right. I mean, think about it. In 2004, you had the Dodgers sell for like $440 million. And less than 10 years later, they sold for $2.7 billion. So,
and if ESPN cannot hand out a big TV contract to the Dodgers or create a special channel for them, if they're not handing over tons of money to football and baseball and basketball and saying, here's hundreds of millions of dollars, here's $1 billion so we can show your programming on ESPN and Fox. If they got less money, they got less money to offer for the programs, which means all those franchises are suddenly worth a lot less money.
That's right. So that's the sports. But what McCain is saying is, hey, you're blacking out sporting events in a stadium that the public paid for. Tax dollars paid to build that stadium in certain instances. So if tax dollars paid for the stadium, you can't black out the games that take place in that stadium.
Is that the particular rule that he's doing there?
Yes, that's the rule that he wants there.
So now nobody cares about Aereo, obviously, except the people at Aereo. But every other element of this omnibus bill, as described in The Hill, is massively popular. People think that they would love a la carte. People, cable companies would love not to have to be bundling ABC with ESPN 2, 3, college, Espanol, etc., right? They'd all love it. The cable companies would love to show football games and ignore the blackout rule. So if it's so popular, if every one of these is massively popular with the public, why is it doomed to fail?
Lobbies, lobbies, lobbies. Follow the money. Because at the end of the day, ESPN, they're not going to take a hit. They're not going to say, oh, yeah, no, please, we'd like to only collect $1.50 per subscriber per month from now on, because, you know, not everybody's going to be paying for it. So let's lower the cost. No, what they're going to do is they're going to say, well, we're going to have fewer customers watching us. Therefore, we have to increase the price. We need to maintain revenue.
It's, doomed to fail because even if it's popular, there's too many entrenched, powerful, you know, financially deep pocket people ready to stop it in its tracks.
Well, and you know, one of the things McCain did say is, look, if you start taking popular event programming, i.e. the Super Bowl, okay, or, you know, big football games or big baseball games or big sporting events, and moving them from over the air must carry television. So ABC, your networks, your broadcast networks. If you start moving that stuff to cable, then you can be penalized. Now, who did that in the past? If you look, Walt Disney owns ABC. They also own ESPN. And they moved Monday Night Football from ABC to ESPN, claiming, oh, not enough people were watching, so we're going to move it to ESPN and get it out of the way. What they were doing there was boosting up the reason for people to have ESPN or want ESPN and making it cost $3 a month per subscriber. And that's effectively, so he's basically going back in time and saying, hey, remember when you did that? Yeah, I don't want that to happen anymore. You guys effectively have monopolies in baseball, in basketball, in football that we allow. And you can't do that. We're not going to allow that. And you're supposed to be doing a public service here. So if you're a broadcast network, we're not going to allow you to just start messing around with what you air.
So we'll keep an eye on that and show you when it crashes and burns in the Congress.
Yeah, because let's face it, it's crashing and burning.
Well, that's it for Inside Baseball, right?
Yes, but we do have one listener email. It comes from Maureen P. in Seattle. She writes, hey, kids, this is all sort of, oh, whoops, I guess I should read it properly. It says, this is sort of a well actually email, or in the words of Homer Simpson, dope. A while back on a few episodes, I heard you guys arguing, or should I say discussing, the music website and mobile app SoundCloud. One of you, and I think it was Michael, said that SoundCloud would never last and that it wasn't very popular. And I think that was you, Michael.
Who said it was.
That. Yeah. It looks like ComScore disagrees with you. According to this article on Hypebot, they say the traffic on the site has increased by 26% to 10.2 million monthly visitors. It's in the top 10 fastest growing sites in the U.S. Looks like SoundCloud might stick around a while. Thanks for all your work on the show each week. Maureen P. in Seattle.
They never call except to chide.
Well, and we do, you know, this isn't necessarily to chide. I think she's trying to say, hey, actually, hey, I read something. And
I was wrong. See, I can be wrong, too.
Well, and I do appreciate it. And I think I speak for you, Michael, as well, that, you know, it's nice to know that when our listeners who have heard one of our shows, and this one is going to be a longer one, that they actually remember some of the stuff and they go back and they let us know about certain updates. Certainly, we know Raul and several other listeners post links on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can also contact us through or follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. Links to all the stories we talked about on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those links to Twitter and Facebook or ways to email us like Maureen did. She emailed dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
And I'd like to say thank you to her. And I'm less impressed with the fact that it's in the top 10 fastest growing sites, because that could be, you know, from 1 to 10 would be a huge growth. It's, 1,000% growth. But, you know, 10.2 million unique monthly visitors, that's a lot. So I'm really surprised and happy to see that. I appreciate her bringing that to our attention.
Well, you can also call and leave us a voicemail, and the number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, and for those outside the country, it's +1-888-567-7263. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher, and you can rate and review the shows in those places. Again, iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, anywhere they give out podcasts for free, generally, you can find us. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has an ever-changing website each week. This week, Michael, what is it?
I won't be in con and I want to cry.com.
Wow. Okay. Well, if you have trouble finding some of Michael's work from places like the Huffington Post and other outlets on that particular website, why not try michaelgiltz.com? And for some of my writing, you can go to celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.